It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been a year since the closing of SCI Pittsburgh. Local leaders initially eyed the state-owned acreage for riverfront development, but 12 months later, there seems to be no progress. Why? And Pennsylvania is in a position to quickly implement sports betting following this week's Supreme Court ruling. That and more, but first. Pennsylvania voters, about one in five registered voters, chose Republican and Democratic nominees for U.S. Senate, 18 seats in the U.S. House, governor, lieutenant governor, plus half the state Senate, and the entire state House. Today, we're going to explore the implications going forward from some of those key races. Joining us in studio, Selena Zito, Pittsburgh-based reporter for the newspaper The Washington Examiner and co-author of the new book, The Great Revolt. Welcome, Selena.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Chris Potter, editor of WESA's Government and Accountability Team. Hello, Chris.
Hey, good to be here.
And on the phone from Harrisburg is Brad Bumstead, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Caucus, the weekly print-only newspaper covering government and politics. Good to have you with us, Brad.
Thank you for having me on board.
So, a lot happened Tuesday night in Pennsylvania's 2018 primary contest. There were a few, well, if not surprises, a few wins that were not a sure thing. To each of you briefly, what was your headline after Tuesday night? Chris Potter, we'll start with you.
A headline, I always have a hard time writing those. I think that this is a low turnout election in which some very passionate base voters who are tired of politics as usual had a really outsized say.
Brad, your headline.
Well, in terms of always trying to look ahead in the story on the headline, it would be primary set stage for testing Trump's strength in PA.
And Selena, what's your headline?
Mine's the disruption continues. Like, as I sort of outlined in The Great Revolt, which is about this populist coalition, I see it across both parties. And for me, looking at all of these results, this movement is firmly ensconced in both parties.
Okay. Before we delve in deeply into some of the particular races, was there a big surprise, Selena?
Not really.
No.
But, you know, I think if as a reporter and you spend time on the ground and you listen to what people say, you kind of get a feeling, and I think Chris and Brad are going to agree with me, that you understand where the voters are going to go. It's not exactly the way the, you know, sort of establishment imagined some of the things. But I think if you listen to the voters' sentiments, you get an understanding that both parties in both primaries are tired of the status quo and they want to shake things up. And I think you saw that across the board. You know, just think about John Fetterman. You know, anybody covering that knew he was going to beat the incumbent lieutenant governor, which, by the way, made history in this state. But, you know, that might have surprised some people.
Brad, any surprises, big or small, that you detected?
Well, I think that the Costa cousins in western Pennsylvania, that would be Paul and Dom in the state house, being defeated by candidates who were backed by the Democratic Socialists, was surprising to me. I did not have any clue that they were going to get knocked off. Lieutenant Governor Stack going down, not a huge surprise. You know, people thought he might be able to pull it out, but that didn't happen because he had a Philadelphia candidate among the four people challenging him, former deputy mayor Nina Ahmad, who got 20% of the vote. That made it easy for Fetterman to, you know, slip right between the cracks and knock him off.
Chris Potter, surprise, big, small, otherwise.
I was, you know, we reported quite a bit here about those two DSA candidates taking on the Costas. So I was not surprised about the outcome. The margin was surprising to me. They did not just beat Dom and Paul Costa. They creamed them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was about 30 points.
Wow.
And I think that really speaks to what's going on here and kind of what Selena's referring to, that there is this sort of ferment. There's just a lot of activism kind of percolating up really in both ranks. The race that did surprise me a little bit, and it's another case where an incumbent fell, was the state Senate District 38. This is Randy Volokovich's seat. And Randy lost to Jeremy Schaefer. I was a little surprised by that, although I know Mr. Schaefer put a lot of his own money in there and had quite a bit of support from an outside organization, too. But I think you can see when you look at kind of both of these parties, both in terms of some of those upsets and even some of the races that played out the way you expected. You know, Lou Barletta won, but it's, you know, against Jim Christiana. But, you know, I don't know that
I was a state rep from Beaver County.
I didn't get a tremendous sense of, at least out here in the West, enthusiasm for Lou Barletta, in part because he barely campaigned. He was hardly visible. I met people who were surprised to see his name on the ballot. So I think there's a lot of discontent out there still. Even after 2016, it seems like the parties have not quite figured out how to get back in sync with their voters.
Okay. Media and others tend to overhype things. Was there one thing that was...
I know, I'm doing my part.
...that overhyped on your part that either didn't live up to what was anticipated? Brad, how about we start with you on that? Anything that was overhyped?
Well, maybe in the aftermath in terms of how it's portrayed. I mean, I think, you know, Fetterman, for instance, is a you know, this was a really important victory for him, and you know, knocking off an incumbent lieutenant governor for the first time in Pennsylvania history. However, you know, in terms of what impact that has in the fall, people don't vote for lieutenant governors or vice presidents for that matter. They vote for, you know, you have a ticket that'll be Wolf and Fetterman, and he may stimulate some enthusiasm among Democrats, clearly, but it's not like it's going to make that much difference in the fall race.
Okay, Selena, overhype.
Well, can I step backward for a second on this? So I don't think much was overhyped in this election. I think that most of the local reporters across the state understood what was going to happen in their districts. Chris was incredible in reporting on the Costa Cousin races. But one of the things that kind of drove me crazy last week was the overhype of Don Blankenship. Yeah. He's going to win in West Virginia. And if anybody spent any time in West Virginia, they would know that that was never going to happen. And that was, to me, a misunderstanding of the Republican Party of their own voters. They don't know who they are.
And remind us who Don Blankenship is.
Don Blankenship was the owner of a coal mine, several coal mines. 29 people died. I forget how many years ago that was. I didn't live in the state, lived in Nevada. I mean, if you know anyone from West Virginia or any state, these are core things that people would find incredibly egregious. And for the Republican establishment to not understand this and sort of feed this to the press, it just tells me they don't understand their electorate either.
Okay. Chris, anything overhyped?
You know, I think we actually did okay with this, here in Pennsylvania. I think there were races where, you know, it was hard to know what was going to happen. There's not a lot of great polling. And even if there were polling in a race like lieutenant governor, I mean, would you believe it? People don't really know what they're doing. A lot of in the Republican gubernatorial side, I think there was a lot of uncertainty. The undecided vote going into that from the polling that I saw was pretty high. So I think reporters were trying to be pretty circumspect about not getting to, out over ahead of their skis here on this one. And I think that made for, you know, fairly restrained reporting. I think, too, that out here in western Pennsylvania, the Saccone-Reschenthaler race, the special election, and I'm sorry, not the special election, the race that happened after the special election, I've gotten so used to those words there. You know, that was another one there where I wasn't surprised by that result. Again, I was somewhat surprised by the margin there that Guy Reschenthaler basically beat Rick Saccone by about 10.5 points.
Well, let's continue that discussion with this was the first test of the newly drawn congressional districts. Let's continue with 14. Anything, the new 14, I should say.
Yeah, you have to, I'm like, wait, where do I live? What district am I in? I wake up every morning. I'm not quite sure.
Selena, did you get the sense that Republican Party leaders sort of gave up on Saccone after his loss to Connor Lamb in the special?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, they didn't they didn't have a stake in it. This is probably one of the few safe seats in the state for Republicans after the redraw of this past winter. And you know, I mean, if you're a party leader and you look at two candidates, it's probably, if you're looking for the future, you probably wanted to go with Guy because he's young, he has a good biography, and Rick Saccone had lost, and that, you know, When you're the guy that's handing out money and bodies to for an election, it leaves a sour taste in your mouth to go with someone that's lost.
Okay. Now, after his win, Reschenthaler said there are no safe Republican seats. So is his message just sort of, hey, we need to get out the vote for November, take full advantage of registration? Isn't the new 14th, shouldn't that be easier to win for the Republicans?
Yeah, it absolutely should be easier. But it doesn't mean, to me, that's a smart politician. That's someone that understands that turnout is everything.
Yeah, and I mean, on the Democratic side, the Democrats picked who I think the general consensus would be was their strongest option, Bibiana Boreo, former automotive executive, was a interim president at Seton Hill College, has Westmoreland County roots. So she's a legitimate candidate. I think, and I think were this in a different environment, you could see maybe Democrats throwing more money at her. The problem that she's going to have, and that Democrats out here are going to have, is that so much of the attention, there's a lot of attention on Pennsylvania from national Dems, but so much of it is on the eastern part of the state, because the perception, and I think it's probably true, is the pickup opportunities are really in that sort of southeastern Pennsylvania area, where you got a lot of suburban voters who weren't enthusiastic about Trump even in 2016, or less enthusiastic about him now. And that's where the real kind of easy ground for digging would seem to be.
Although, don't you think that maybe the Lamb-Rothfuss race might get national attention? Because, that's like a classic swing district.
Yeah, it is now, right?
Yeah. it is now, the new one. But I think those ones are like the most interesting, because those ones actually come down to like localism. What's most important for the constituents, and I always find them more fascinating.
Brad, as bureau chief of the caucus based in Harrisburg, what about any interesting congressional races in your part of the state or even farther east?
Well, no, I think the most interesting one, and I didn't cover the race, so I can't speak to it, but it's the one that drew a couple state representatives into it, the district based in Altoona. Was eventually won by a physician or optometrist. I forget what he does, but you had State Senator John Eichelberger in the race. You had Representative Steve Bloom in the race. Both of them lost originally. The House Majority Leader Dave Reed was going to try to get in that race, but I guess the way the district lines were drawn, he couldn't. But that's the one because of state legislators being involved in it that got some attention. But other than that, no. And our focus is almost 100% on governor, lieutenant governor, and the state legislature.
And we're going to talk about those in just a minute. Selena.
I also think maybe the Matt Cartwright race. He's a Democratic representative. He's out in sort of the Luzerne County area. That area swung a dramatic 28 points towards Trump within that district, the way his district used to look. But even as it's reconfigured, it's still a Trump-heavy district. And while I always argue, and especially in the book, that this movement, Trump was the result of it. He didn't cause it. I still see that sentiment out there. So there could be a Republican pickup out there. I would keep my eyes on that race as well.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. We're looking at the results of the May primary and looking ahead to what this might involve in the November general elections. So I wanted one more about the congressional races. So a bit of background. So right now, 6 Democrats are in office, 10 Republicans, 2 seats are vacant due to the retirement of Charlie Dent and Patrick Meehan resigning in April. 3 House Republicans did not seek re-election, plus 1 Democratic incumbent did not. So all of that, people leaving office, not seeking re-election, what are some fascinating seats? Are there one that's more likely to flip than another?
It's one thing is certain. Everything is uncertain. if anybody could sit here and predict exactly what happens, they're either like a brilliant soothsayer or they just got lucky. But it's really difficult to follow. And I think the Dent and the Meehan situation with their retirements create this really crazy sort of soap opera because the people that are running to replace them have to run in the seat as it used to exist. But then just a month or so later, then they have to rerun in a completely different district. Yeah. Is that right?
I'm not an expert on how they're handling it out east at all, to be honest with you. I'll just go back to Kevin's question. I think, as Selena said before, you know, this Rothfuss Connor Lamb race will be interesting to watch for sure. And you can already see these two guys kind of positioning themselves. You know, Lamb voting very strategically, clearly for an eye towards, you know, what kind of ads this guy. One thing Connor Lamb knows, it's about what it's like to be the subject of negative advertising. So you can already see him taking some very cautious votes, you know, kind of lining up with some Republicans on kind of some procedural votes and things like that to kind of be able to burnish his moderate bona fides between now and November. So I think that race will be fascinating. But of course, again, because of the way it works out here, it's a push. I mean, Democrats are very likely to lose this 14th district. Guy Rensselaer, all the landscape favors him. But on the other hand, they can take this seat from Rothfuss. So at the end of the day, what you end up with is a Pittsburgh area that's got, you know, right now has two Democrats and one Republican, and may well end up being in exactly the same position come November.
All right, let's move on to a governor. By the way, then Congressman Meehan resigned because of sexual misconduct allegations. So governor, no surprises, I don't think, with Scott Wagner winning the Republican nomination. You have some similarities, Wagner and the incumbent Wolf. Two white multimillionaires. What are the key differences that will be focused upon? Let's start with you, Brad.
Well, I think that there's some similarities. You can start with the fact that they're both from York County, and they're both businessmen who. But Wagner points out that I'm a successful businessman, but I did it by starting to throw cans onto a garbage truck. And I did this work my way up, Horatio Alger story, while Wolf inherited his money. That's what Wagner will say. But the differences go well beyond their wealth and how they acquired it. It's temperament. I mean, I think that Governor Wolf is an easygoing, some would say likable guy who it's hard to dislike for a lot of reasons. Wagner is fiery. He gets right to the point. He'll go for the jugular on an issue. And in this age, it may be what voters want. Who knows? I mean, given what the kind of themes that Selena is exploring and has talked about in her book. And, I mean, I think it is that something that's remains to be seen, but Wagner had really endorsed Trump and stood behind him, and I presume he still will, and that may be a factor in this race as well.
Okay, very briefly, Chris and Selena, what will Wagner have to do to carry Pennsylvania as Donald Trump did in the 16 presidential race and even back to Tom Corbett doing for governor in 2010? Very briefly, please.
Well, the way Trump won Pennsylvania was turning out counties that typically don't have an over-enthusiastic base. So we're looking at counties like Luzerne, Erie, Butler, Washington, Westmoreland counties. He needs to bump up his turnout by about 2,000 votes more than the last gubernatorial than Corbett did in the last gubernatorial race. So that would offset the largesse that comes out of Philadelphia.
Okay, Chris.
I'd say the one thing he has to do is distinguish himself slightly from Trump. One advantage Trump had was there was a certain, and I know Selena met a lot of them, union voters, rank and file voters who are willing to get behind him. I've talked to, and this is just purely anecdotal, a lot of union guys who would sooner die than vote for Scott Wagner because of some of the positions he's taken. He hasn't been in office for a long time, but he is very bombastic and voluble. He's taking positions that unions really have a problem with, and he may face more headwinds from that direction than Trump had to.
I agree.
Okay, very briefly, you alluded to earlier the two longtime Democratic incumbents in the state House were upset by Democrat socialists. Were these contests an aberration, part of a movement, something in between?
Both. I mean, I think they were partly an aberration. These are two candidates the incumbent Democrats had not really faced a spirited challenge. And I can tell you, as somebody who interviewed them early on, they were not prepared for this, and they didn't get prepared for it, even though one of their other cousins, Ron Costa, lost to a Democratic Socialist candidate in a local judicial race last fall. So they weren't ready for it. But I think one thing these parties need to do is realize what the DSA does very, very well. They're kind of a new thing because of Bernie Sanders, but what they're doing is old school politics. Yep. They're out there, they're knocking doors, they're pounding the streets. And they have a party that's not just about sort of who you endorse. It's a kind of a social and a cultural thing as well. And parties used to provide that back in the day, and the DSA is doing it now.
100% what Chris said. The DSA employed the tactics that are really important for a grassroots movement. You have to have good candidates, but you also have to have good supporters that are throughout the community, not just, you know, knocking on doors, coffee houses, bowling alleys, you know, those sort of communal things that promote the localism that inspires people to turn out. And the DSA did that very effectively.
Yeah, they were everywhere on election day. Yeah, every polling place.
Okay, what story are you going to keep your eye on, whatever the level of race it is, as we progress in the weeks ahead? Brad, very quickly, please.
Well, the governor's race and how it is that these two gentlemen, Wolf and Wagner, distinguish themselves. Where Wagner goes in particular, he doesn't have a long record in the Senate. It's 4 years. There are some votes that can be criticized, but he can maneuver a little bit as opposed to, say, a 20-year incumbent. And he has tried to do some things that are populist in nature, not necessarily liberal, but, you know, he supported a very, very conservative minimum wage increase, and he has legislation that would clear the criminal records of people for minor crimes after so many years. Clean slate, I think it's called.
Chris Potter.
I think Wagner is fascinating, but I think in a lot of these races, I'm going to be looking, paying a special attention more than I used to in the past to the suburbs, kind of what kind of political ferment is taking place out there, because that's going to decide a lot of these races.
And Selena Zito, from a national perspective or a Pittsburgh area perspective?
Both. Congressional delegation. I think the whole delegation tells you whatever happens in Pennsylvania and who wins the majority in November. Our delegation and what the body looks like is fascinating watching it.
Selena Zito is a Pittsburgh-based reporter for the Washington Examiner and co-author of the book, The Great Revolt. Brad Bumstead is Capitol Bureau Chief of the Caucus, and Chris Potter is editor of WESA's Government Accountability and Politics team. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It appears to be prime real estate for development. So a year later, why is little happening at the site of the former Pittsburgh State Prison? That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The editor of the local alternative weekly newspaper, Pittsburgh City Paper, was fired this week. He says it's because the paper's parent company didn't like his coverage of conservative state lawmaker Daryl Metcalf. The paper's owner didn't provide a reason for the firing. And a new report found Allegheny County lost 11,000 acres of tree canopy in recent years, or as much as the county's entire park system. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up in a few minutes, SCI Pittsburgh, a vacant state prison, has sat idle for a year. What's to come of that riverfront site? But first, a new law enforcement development about police forces that help put the inmates into those state prisons and jails. Of the 130 municipalities in the county, 18 have neighboring police departments patrolling their streets. 2 rely on state police troopers, and there's 1 regional police department in the northern suburbs covering 4 communities. Now, 4 neighborhoods along the Route 28 corridor, Aspinwall, Blonox, O'Hara, and Sharpsburg, have signed a letter of intent to create a regional police department, with Fox Chapel considering joining them. We're going to talk a bit about if police consolidation is a growing practice with David Harris, host of the Criminal and Justice Podcast, law professor at the University of Pittsburgh, and WESA's legal analyst. Welcome, David.
Hi, Kevin. Good to be with you.
Okay. There are still some steps needed before this proposed regional police force materializes, getting state technical assistance, a feasibility study. The majority of municipalities in the county across the state, they do have their own police departments. But is this, when they consider the consolidation, strictly an economic issue, or does it go beyond that?
Well, it's more than just economics, though. Economics typically drives it. These police departments are typically very small, 5, 10, maybe 15 officers, 50 at most. And these are expensive to run, though everybody likes to have their own local police departments and local police officers. You get beyond economics, though, and you get questions of supporting a set of municipal services that you can get elsewhere and have still a local feel to them. With a police department that's very small, you also have issues of whether you can train them well enough, whether you're going to get the same level of service. All of those things become part of the equation. And hopefully we'll get more municipalities thinking this way, because these small police departments often are not the best solution if you're thinking in terms of the quality of service and how citizens, not just in those municipalities, but in the region in general, get treated by police.
David, I know you talk with police officials elsewhere in different parts of the country. Is this an issue, at least the studying of consolidation elsewhere?
Yes, it is. I remember after Ferguson, I got lots of calls from journalists from the St. Louis region, and they say, do you realize we have 50 police departments in this county alone? I said, man, you got nothing on us. We're well over 100. So this is something that's nationwide. And the problem can be with these small police departments, they look for other revenue sources. They set up the equivalent of speed traps in many different ways. We know that the departments in Missouri, in St. Louis County, just to take one example, they were arresting people, citing people, getting them into the system as a way of funding themselves. And this is the kind of thing that we really want to avoid.
Okay. Now, with fewer departments, might you have more consistent training of police officers and therefore more consistent responses to issues in their communities?
Well, that would certainly be the hope. If you can afford good, consistent training, you should have better service overall, better responses, and an overall better department. The smaller the department, typically, the less well you can pay officers, the less well you can train them, and the less standardized the service becomes. It becomes quirky. It becomes local. That's the flip side of localism. Everybody wants their own department, but you should have it operating according to best practices or as close as you can get it, and you'll get a better department if it's a slightly bigger one, more regional.
For smaller communities faced with difficulties in maintaining a force, is consolidation the answer, or should state police take responsibility?
Well, I think it's good in Pennsylvania that we have at least two options. You can have the state police step in. We also have a county police force, the Allegheny County Police Force, and then we can have these smaller regional departments as well, like we have, like you were explaining earlier. All of these are better choices than a completely atomized set of over 100 agencies. We have to remember that crime and criminals and gangs do not respect these lines. So you could have a gang beef where people are in Pittsburgh, they're in Penn Hills, they're over on the north side, they're in this place and that place. The more we can consolidate, the better off the whole region will be.
David, stay with us. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. The last inmates transferred out of SCI Pittsburgh, formerly Western Penitentiary, left the lockup about a year ago tomorrow when the Wolf administration announced it was closing SCI Pittsburgh to save the state millions annually. City officials, though unhappy with the loss of some local prison jobs, also saw a major development opportunity of more than 24 riverfront acres. WESA legal analyst David Harris remains with us and joining us in studio, who's written extensively about the redevelopment, or lack of, is Post-Gazette reporter Kate Giamarisi. Kate, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
So the size of the property, what are we talking about?
Well, I'm not certain of the exact number of buildings. It's quite a few, and it's about 24 acres in total. So it's a pretty large site, is my understanding.
Okay. And the state owns all of that, correct?
Yes. So that's still owned by the state.
So the original prison, I believe, was built 1882, even with a major rework. Could you actually make any reuse of the big prison structure?
Well, that's what people are looking into right now. Some of the folks that I spoke to certainly said any reuse would be challenging, could be challenging just because of the way it's built with a lot of interior walls, you know, because it was a prison. Right. So certainly that's what people are looking into right now. And but you know, some of the folks that I spoke to who toured the site did say that any reuse would not be an easy, simple proposition.
Okay. So we're talking about an imposing site. I mean, it's right there on the river. It's connected to the riverfront trail used by Pittsburghers enjoying the outdoors. David, this is a solid structure.
You look at it and it says only one thing, prison. You can't imagine it as some other kind of building. It's not welcoming. It's meant to keep people in there. It practically speaks pain and penalty.
It certainly is.
Local leaders, when the announcement came that it was going to close, I talked to Mayor Peduto, County Exec Rich Fitzgerald. They were all talking about redevelopment opportunities, working with the state, maybe in the state giving over the property to the URA. What's the status with it right now?
You know, at the time when the state announced the closure, the redevelopment potential of this site was something that, you know, everybody talked about, and state officials even said that that factored into the calculation of why they chose to close this particular institution rather than certain other prisons that are located in more rural areas. Redevelopment is a bit of a slower process. Basically, everyone I spoke to recently used the words due diligence a lot. They want to do their due diligence about the site's history. It's in a floodplain, right. So there's some flooding issues.
Remediation?
That is basically all still being investigated. The one thing, though, that I did want to mention is because this is still owned by the state, they would be selling this to the URA or to any other interested party. It wouldn't necessarily be given. The last two prisons that this state closed and then sold, they sold basically online through the RFP process, and you could go and look it up on the state's, you know, e-marketplace website. There were some community meetings last year. I did not attend those, but my colleagues did. My sort of understanding is that folks were pretty vocal about what they did not wish to see on that site.
David, this is not strictly a Pennsylvania issue. Is it when prisons are closed elsewhere in the country? What happens?
Well, first and foremost, people worry about the jobs. And I think people can get caught up in the fact that there are a lot of employees in the correctional department who, in a prison closure or a consolidation of prisons, might lose employment. But we have to remember that prisons are a very particular government function. They're not jobs programs. And so what we win or lose in jobs or real estate or redevelopment, that all is aside from the fact of whether closing a prison is a good idea. We had prison expansion for decades through the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, and those were looked upon as economic benefits. So if that goes away from a community, that's just because of public policy decisions that are being made now, just as they were before. So we have to remember that this is not primarily about the economics or the government finances. This is about how many prisons we need vis-a-vis the criminal justice system.
What else can prisons be used for, the structures that were former prisons?
Honestly, not a lot. I mean, I spent some years in Philadelphia, and I can still remember, you know, pulling up on my bicycle at the Eastern State Penitentiary at on Fairmont Avenue. It's five blocks from the Art Museum. There were all kinds of efforts there for years and years to do something, sell it to somebody, redevelop it. It is still there. It is now a kind of tourist attraction, sort of like Alcatraz without having to go out to an island. It's a pretty tough thing to do something with it. These things are built to last. There are the massive walls designed to keep people in. It's not welcoming. You'd have to do a ton of remediation, like Kate was saying. I don't think that these will be an easy sell or an easy redevelopment.
Okay, we have just about a minute left. Are they even getting to that, whether they're using it for films? I think they did some filming last summer.
Yeah, I think there's been some filming.
But community services, anything like that? Are they even getting to that point?
You know, my understanding is that they're so early in this process that, you know, those types of, like, specific discussions, specific uses, they're not that far along yet.
Okay, so your predictions, if you would. You know, it's been a year since the last prisoners moved out, officially closed, I believe, June 30th of 17. Will the former SCI Pittsburgh be sitting there for a while? Briefly, David.
It is going to be sitting there for a while. This won't be an easy task. It's going to take years and years.
And Kate will be sitting there for a while. And what will you be following up on?
Yeah, my understanding is that nothing is really happening in the immediate near future, you know, other than this, like I mentioned, preliminary studying and due diligence. But yes, myself and my colleagues will certainly be paying attention to whatever happens.
Kate Giamarese is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. David Harris is the host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast. He's a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh and WESA's legal consultant. Thanks so much to both of you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up, ready, set, bet. Pennsylvania's in line to legalize sports betting. Next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Andy Warhol Museum opens on the North Shore in 1994. The 88,000 square foot former industrial warehouse is the largest museum in the continent dedicated to a single artist, Pittsburgh native Andy Warhol. It's one of the four Carnegie Museums of Pittsburgh and features 17 galleries filled with Warhol's paintings, films, sculptures, and photographs. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for May 18th, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania is ahead of the curve on sports betting. And now that the U.S. Supreme Court has struck down legal barriers, the Commonwealth could become one of the first to have a fully formed market in place. Joining us to talk about the industry, as it is, as it could be, our reporters Gary Rotstein with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Good to have you here, Gary.
Thank you, Kevin.
And from the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review, Wes Fantischer. Welcome back, Wes.
Good to be here, Kevin.
So, gentlemen, the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board said Monday that its staff will need to write regulations that will make legal sports betting a reality. But lawmakers prospectively legalized it last October in a sweeping expansion of the casino law. I don't have to tell you to. Pittsburgh is crazy about its sports team. What are your anticipations about how this action by the Supreme Court and the legalization of sports betting might change how the city lives and breathes its football, hockey, baseball? Wes, we want to start with you.
Well, yeah, that's a great question. There's not a lot of precedent to try to figure that out. Nevada is the only state that has legalized sports betting. Haven't seen lots of big impacts on the games there. The main concerns are integrity of the game and how to preserve that. A lot of what the experience will be like in the city depends on how those regulations do shake out, what types of bets are allowed, and what they do to protect the integrity of the games.
And Gary, neither of you are sports reporters for your publications, but you're aware of just how important sports are. I mean, what's your sense of what impact this might have on sports fans and the culture climate of Pittsburgh?
There's a lot of intertwining between gambling and sports. Nobody can deny that. The leagues would attempt to deny, have a little bit of a hands-off attitude towards that. But the prospect of many more people being able to place a bet and do it easily obviously is going to have a big impact on the popularity of the different sports, on the TV ratings for the sports, and just your average everyday discussion among people. There's going to be a lot of people talking about betting on a game in a way that was not happening, although it would be folly to pretend that a lot of people were not already doing it illegally
We mentioned that Pennsylvania is on track, maybe even ahead of the curve, but this just can't happen tomorrow. What still needs to be done involving the Gaming Control Board? What still has to be done to implement this?
Well, the board has the authorization, essentially, of the legislature, and they're crafting the regulations, how it's going to look, as we were talking about, in terms of what types of bets can be placed, where exactly it can happen. It looks like it will be able to happen on the internet, in casinos. There are 12 in the state now. A 13th is being built. These 10 mini casinos are being built. It could be pretty widespread.
In the sense of, you know, this can't happen tomorrow, but it's not that far off if the Gaming Control Board moves quickly.
It's months, most likely. Right. Not days, not weeks, but probably not years.
Possibly by the start of the new NFL season in September?
That's what a lot of Steelers fans would be hoping, no doubt, and very possible that that will be true. There will be some states ahead of us, New Jersey most likely, and a couple of others that already have things a little bit more in place. But compared to a lot of states, we're also going to be quicker than most of those because we already have the authorizing legislation, and there's only a handful of states that had the foresight and anticipation to do that.
Well, you mentioned New Jersey. That Garden State spent years fighting the sports betting ban in court, culminating in the victory in the U.S. Supreme Court. So they really wanted it, didn't they?
They see revenue coming into the state from it, just like Pennsylvania sees. In a way, the one of the concerns about Pennsylvania from the gaming industry is a very high tax rate that we will have on sports betting and a high fee of $10 million for the casinos to enter into it. No other state that has done the authorization has the types of fees and tax rates that Pennsylvania is planning. So it remains to be seen how that's going to shake out.
And who sets that tax rate? Is it the Gaming Control Board? Somebody else?
The legislature did that.
The legislature. Pennsylvania's tax rate is 34%, I believe. At $1.4 billion, Pennsylvania is already the number one state in tax revenue from casino gambling. How high could that number get, even with that maybe that barrier of a 34% tax rate? Are there any projections of what Pennsylvania could bring in, or at least hope for projections?
The American Gaming Association has done some estimates state by state. You know, there are a lot of variables involved, but the estimate that they came up with was $26 million a year in gaming tax revenue for Pennsylvania. That's kind of a drop in the bucket, considering last year the Pennsylvania legislature was looking at a $2 billion deficit that they had to plug.
One thing to consider about sports betting, while it's very popular among the average person, a lot of talk, a lot of interest in watching games because of it, it is not really a high revenue driver for casinos, so thus it will not be for the state either. The margin of profit that a casino makes from people who bet on a sports game is much less than the people who put money in the slots, as well as the volume being less, or from the other types of table games. What the casinos like is if you have people coming in to bet on sports, many of those people also wager and spend money in other ways on restaurants and drinks there, and they have people who come in with them. So it just adds to the overall volume of the casino in general, as opposed to being a high profit motivator to start with.
Not necessarily a loss leader, but just something to draw people in.
Correct. Although at Pennsylvania's tax rate, there is some concern at a loss leader might end up being an apt term. Well, that remains to be seen.
Wes, I believe the Trib spoke with some casinos, a few casinos. What are they saying?
Yeah, so I spoke with the head of Meadows Casino, the PR person, and also with Rivers. They are saying that they're really excited. You know, they take every opportunity they can to complain about Pennsylvania's taxes. And they did this in the last expansion and ended up jumping at these opportunities. So they're saying that that might give them a little pause. But given the fact that Pennsylvania is one of the only five states to be right out in front of this, I think there's a good chance that they will be opening a lot of stuff up. And it's going to be the way they described it to me was sports bar style setups where there's a bunch of screens with games on, people can place bets, they can do other types of gaming while they're watching the games, that type of thing.
You alluded to earlier, gentlemen, that it's not just the casinos. Where else, if I want to bet on the Steelers or another football team, where could this happen? You mentioned, I believe, Gary, the internet could be done.
Right. I think right now under the legislation that was authorized, it will be at the 12 existing casinos plus the 13th in Philadelphia, plus most likely the mini casinos. One of those is being added near Greensburg, another near Newcastle over the next couple of years, and probably also over the internet. And it would take some new legislation to expand it. But there's no telling. The way things have expanded in Pennsylvania over the years in gambling, there's no telling where it all ends.
What have we heard regarding the sports teams or even the leagues themselves? How have they responded to this Supreme Court ruling?
So far, local sports teams have been quiet. They're trying to see how it shakes out before they give an opinion on it. The Penguins, Pirates have each weighed in that regard. The major leagues all were officially opposed to this, and they were plaintiffs in the lawsuit. But inside conversations have been somewhat more flexible with it. The NBA, I think, has been one of those that's been most open to it, talking about accompanying it with some kind of integrity fee that would be spent, you know, trying to keep games fair.
Yeah, they sort of talk about out of both sides of their mouths in general and sort of kind of like condemning gambling's impact in general, but also realizing the money to be made from it and that they would really like to do anything to boost their own revenue, such as the integrity fee that Wes mentioned, that they're gonna try and get their cut out of it as well, which all remains to be seen.
We just have a few minutes remaining. Could this have broader implications for other industries, for people who want to bet on sports legally? We're talking Nevada. Maybe even the popularity of the direct flight from Pittsburgh to Vegas.
I don't think a lot of people go out to Las Vegas specifically for sports betting, even though it's the only place legally to do that, because you have other avenues to do that right now. And the people who go out to Las Vegas who spend a lot of money are more often associated with other forms of gambling out there.
Okay, so people already bet illegally. We know that. Say with a bookie, why might somebody switch if, number one, you're betting illegally and you're not paying taxes on it?
There's the proponents of this talk about how you can regulate the industry, make it safer for people to make wagers. You don't have to worry about getting into conflicts with your bookie that by some stereotype can lead to bad things. We don't hear too much of that happening, but who knows? But it's regulated and safe, and it's a lot of the same as with marijuana, recreational marijuana, the same kind of arguments. This is going on anyway, so state by state, it's being approved under the context of, well, if it's going on anyway, let's have state government get a share of revenue, and let's make it safer and police it and regulate it better.
Wes?
That will be an interesting thing to watch, Kevin. The AGA estimates, the American Gaming Association, that $150 billion worth is illegally wagered on sports each year. And so how much of that will transfer over to legal, we'll see. It'll be interesting also to see if they crack down more on illegal gaming when it's regulated and legalized too.
Illegal gaming, right?
Yes.
Okay. In our remaining minute, I wanted to ask you this. Is there something that you want to know, a question that you want answered, an aspect of this story that you'll be following in the weeks ahead? Wes, we'll start with you.
One thing I'm kind of curious about, one or two legislators have expressed a little bit of reservation about this. And one thing that they've said is, how is this going to affect horse betting in Pennsylvania? Long tradition here. It seems like they have positioned themselves pretty well. They get hundreds of millions of dollars worth of subsidy per year. And if that industry comes out in opposition to this, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Gary?
I'm a little curious what it'll actually look like, the sports betting venues in Pennsylvania. If you go to Las Vegas, the large casinos have large rooms with plush armchairs and couches to watch games on giant TV screens and a whole big section of the casino dedicated to this. It's a little hard to picture that in the existing casinos, the way they're set up in Pennsylvania, but I guess it'll be determined by how much revenue potential there is to gain from it as to what they want to invest in making this a really big part of the casino experience or not.
Gary Rothstein is a reporter with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Wes Van Teicher writes for the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Evan.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Research and production assistance from Avery Keatley. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.